Howdy. Y'all listening to Radio Flange Goblet, and tonight's episode of the After Movie Diner is brought to you by Spen G6, a miracle cure for oranging of the buttocks, chimpanzee infestation, an annoyingly whiny ant or dog fanatic falling face first into Scott Bakula, I've done it and I wouldn't advise it, and the swollen feet of an Olympic pole vaulter after several rounds of violent earlobe torture at the hands of some game show hosts and a puppet named Eric.
Ghouls, goblins, grannies in horrifying eyeshadow, and ghastly guests. Welcome to the month of Horrortober on the podcast from the After Movie Diner, where no creepy castle is left unbloodied, where no dark passageway is left unexplored, no night is left unbumped, and no spooky cabin full of voluptuous wenches is left standing. Every week, we will be delving deep into the uncharted, foggy bowers of man's domain, pulling out, dusting off, and wiping free of sticky dribble a series of terrifying, pants-soiling, and downright frightful films from the horror genre. There'll be walking corpses, snowbound massacres, angry, deathly policemen, freakish, fanged beasties, and Lawrence Fishburne aplenty. Join us now, dear listener. If ye be strong of heart, commanding of bowel, and firm of buttock, for our dance with the morbid, squalid, maddening, and macabre is now about to begin. You have been warned.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to the After Movie Diner, where the booths have been highly polished, the table licked to a deep sheen, the countertops reupholstered in fur, and the toilets painted an attractive shade of black to hide many, many sins, for this exceptionally special episode. Despite having conducted the interview a couple of weeks ago, and despite triple-checking with my wife, my spiritual advisor Arnold, and a defrocked rabbi I befriended in Walgreens, sat here speaking the words out loud to you now, I simply can't believe this is happening. My thighs are certainly a quiver, I won't lie. For our second episode of Horrortober, I'm exceptionally honoured and over the moon to welcome to the show a senator, a terrorist, a prisoner, a fighter of demons, a general, the president no less, and even death himself. And yes, I'm talking about all the same guy. An actor whose screen presence, longevity, and charm is matched only by his skill and versatility. He's the man you want in your ensemble. He's the man doing the work you might not recognize on first viewing, but is the reason behind your enjoyment of repeat viewings. He has shone in standout performances in films such as Die Hard 2, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Tales from the Crypt Presents Demon Knight, Freaked, Trespass, and The Shawshank Redemption, and continues to entertain in two of the most anticipated releases of 2013, Iron Man 3 and Machete Kills. He graciously agreed to talk to us, and I honestly have nothing but good things to say about the man, so I shall stop now and say hello instead to Mr. William Sadler. How are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
I'm very good. So thank you so much for joining us in the After Movie Diner this afternoon. I just wanted to ask you a few questions just about your career and what you've got going on at the moment.
Of course.
So what first got you into acting?
It started back in high school. I did my first play. I guess I'd spent my entire childhood running around the barn improvising, you know, these long action stories with my friends around the neighborhood, you know, diving out of the hayloft with my BB gun and coming up shooting. And
yeah.
It was like whatever show was big on television, that's what we acted out in the in the field and around the farm and in the barn and so on. So I sort of feel like I spent my entire childhood rehearsing for some of the films that I've done. But when I had an English teacher in high school named Dan Larkin who sort of turned me on to acting, and I never looked back. I found it enormously satisfying, and I was pretty good at it from the get-go. I mean, I seemed to have some like natural instincts about it, and I loved. I also just loved the process of examining human, you know, the human condition, human motivations, and why do people do the things they do. I found it fascinating.
And was it always for sort of TV and film, or were you interested in theatre as well? Have you done a lot of theatre as well?
Oh, no, theatre was, it was all theatre for the first, I did the first play in 68, and then studied it in undergraduate at Geneseo for 4 years, then graduate at Cornell University for 2 more years, all theatre. Then 11 years of theatre in New York City. And then I did my first movie.
Okay.
So I've recently gone back, to Broadway. Theater is my home. Theater is my training ground.
Yeah.
For the first decade and a half or so.
Yeah.
Which I think helps a lot. I really do. I wouldn't trade that for the world, because you don't get time. When you're doing movies, if you're fortunate enough to do movies or television, there simply isn't time to do the research, to do the homework, to do the rehearsal, to find your way. If you can't make, you're really pretty much on your own.
Yeah. And you've worked a lot with Frank Darabont, starting, of course, with The Shawshank Redemption. What are your memories particularly of that film?
I should let you know that Frank came up to me. Frank was a writer on Tales from the Crypt.
Right, yes.
The series Tales from the Crypt, and I did the first episode of Tales from the Crypt. He came up to me on the set, and he said, "I'm going to do this movie, and I'd like you to be part of it." And he gave me, not the script, I don't think he'd written it yet, but he gave me a copy of the Stephen King novella that he based it on, that he wrote it from. And of course, I thought, when he did that, he hadn't directed anything before that, and I didn't know who he was, and I was like, yeah, of course you will. Every cab driver in L.A. has got a script they're going to make a movie out of. So
yeah.
I was less than convinced, but I read it, and sure enough, a year or so later, he made the movie and I got the call. But my experience of actually filming the film, actually doing the film, yeah, it was so satisfying. I have really wonderful memories. It's 20 years ago now, but I have such distinct memories of sitting across the table from Morgan and Tim and James Whitmore and this sort of collection of wonderful actors first, and as opposed to movie stars. It had this wonderful ensemble feeling, and I remember it feeling like everybody brought their A game.
Yeah,
which you always should in any case, but it's sort of like playing tennis with McEnroe or somebody. Mm-hmm. You rise to the level of the players around you immediately. Nobody wants to be the one who drops the ball in such esteemed,
yeah,
gathering. So, but it made it very, very fun. It was like everybody was paying attention. Everybody was in it up to their necks. It was a truly ensemble affair. And I remember talking to Frank about this afterwards, and years afterwards, they went out of their way to find theater trained actors.
Yeah,
it was important to them that they people this world with strong actors who could share the scene, collectively.
Yeah.
Throw the ball back and forth and back and forth, and that's what, and I think I personally think that is a lot of what people respond to in this, that it has such a strong ensemble feel, as opposed to there's one huge leading actor and everybody else is just window dressing
I think it's not really thought of necessarily as an ensemble film, but that group forms around the Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins sort of friendship, partnership. And that group is sort of a big part of the sort of middle section of the film. And that really comes across, that you're all playing off each other and interacting. And, you know, and that's, like you said, that's the heart of the film. It's the strength of the film. It's the, it's great. Right. And obviously that's been quite a journey. It's gone, it's obviously taken on this whole new life of being at the top of everyone's, you know, top 100 film list and everything like that. It's kind of become this classic, hasn't it? From
interesting as well that when it opened, it didn't do much business in the theaters. It actually closed. It opened and then closed a few weeks later because no one came out to see a long prison movie with a funny name. I guess the people who saw it probably enjoyed it, but it wasn't until it was nominated for all the Academy Awards that they re-released it. And, you know, then people felt like, I guess we should take a look at this. It's up for Best Picture. And then it came out in video before DVDs. And I think a great many people discovered it on video. So.
Definitely. I think that.
But it's extraordinary. It's just an amazing. Yeah, it's taken on a life of its own. It's wonderful.
And obviously, you've worked with Frank again, and he has a sort of stable of actors that he sort of frequently uses, as you and Jeffrey DeMunn and people like that. What's the working relationship like with him, and also sort of his fellow group of actors that he uses all the time? What's that like?
With Frank. It's a pretty lovely relationship, actually. I mean, I feel very, very honored to be in that stable, that sort of rep company.
Yeah.
I was in The Green Mile and then The Mist again with another Frank Darabont movie.
Yeah, working with Frank
is fun. He's his knowledge of old films, of the history of the cinema, is encyclopedic. It's absolutely. He's such a lover of the form.
Yeah.
That energy just gets infused. It infects everybody on the set. He gets as excited as a 10-year-old kid on Christmas Day when a scene is going well. It's like he's jumping out of his skin. His excitement about it is just infectious, and it makes it very fun to work with him. I think he's gotten freer. Maybe he described, I know in Shawshank everything was planned and every shot was composed and planned, and they'd lay track and lighted and rehearsed and so on. It was very carefully set out. And I think by the time we get to The Mist, he's working with two handheld cameras shooting, you know, at the same time. And it's much more improvised feel to it. He describes it as like the difference between classical music and jazz. I think he just has a freer hand with it now.
Yeah.
It's the same energy and the same sensibilities, but a much freer hand.
Definitely.
I think he's having more fun with it all now. Which is terrific.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Obviously, action fans know you from Hard to Kill and Die Hard 2. What was it like playing those two iconic villains? And was there a sense of a sort of golden age of action going on at the sort of end of the 80s, early 90s?
I guess there was. I came to Los Angeles and almost immediately fell into, I guess Hard to Kill was the first one. And the era of the big action.
Yeah, Hard to Kill.
The Lethal Weapons and the Die Hards and those summer blockbuster juggernauts. Yeah, I guess I was a fan of those films. I was a big fan of the first Die Hard. I thought that was pretty terrific.
Yeah, oh, it's great.
I never had any idea that I was going to end up being the villain in the second one. But that was... That very first episode of Tales from the Crypt came along, and it was produced by Joel Silver. That series was produced by One of the producers was Joel Silver, who did the Die Hard films. And I played this executioner in the Tales from the Crypt series. And I guess when they started thinking, who can we get to play the villain in the second one, I became an idea, which was great. It was big and very visible, and I had to be naked, which is always an interesting way to introduce yourself to the movie-going public.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that either. It's not in the script. Rennie Harlan came up. I actually went to the costume fitting, and there was no costume for that scene. And I said to Rennie, where's the costume for the hotel room scene? And he said, well, Bill, actually, I was thinking you might be nude.
Typical European, then.
Yeah, well, he's Finnish, you know. It's like,
yeah, of course.
It's like, of course he's going to be nude. And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, okay, you push that scene off to the end of the filming and get me a trainer, get me into the gym.
I was going to say, yes, because if you weren't planning to be naked, had you worked out a lot? Like,
no, I never worked out. I was like a big lazy actor, you know. I wasn't ready to do that at all. And I really didn't want to see myself up there 40 feet wide on a summer blockbuster, Die Hard 2.
Yeah.
And look at it 20 years later and think, ah, man, I wish you'd done a few sit-ups. So I worked my ass off, literally. But it was, I like those films. I guess I never thought about it that way, that was sort of those big action blockbuster things.
Because, of course, all those guys are coming back now, you know, with Expendables and things like that. All that sort of stuff has come back to the forefront. So,
I know. Yeah. It's just a sea of wrinkles. And I don't know. They're tough guys. They're nice guys for the most part. They tend to be very decent guys. And
yeah, what was working with Seagal like? I mean, Steven Seagal, because obviously he has a sort of variety of reputations in terms of what he's done and who he is. But I just wondered, what was it like? It was your first big film, right? I think.
He was just an interesting... he was an interesting actor to work with. The very first... I auditioned for him. I read for him in an office at Warner Brothers one afternoon when they were casting this thing, and I'm... There's a moment in the script where I guess we meet in a park bench at a zoo or something, and he says, by the time he grabs me by the throat in the script and says, the average human reaction time is 0.2 seconds and blah, blah, by the time that I could rip your throat out. And in the audition, I'm sitting in this office at Warner Brothers. We got to that place and he dove over the coffee table, grabbed me and slammed me against the wall, pinned my neck to the wall with his hand.
Wow.
And kept going with the lines, kept going with the scene.
Yeah.
Right? And I kept going with the scene. I didn't... I'm convinced that's why I got the job.
Right.
Because I didn't go, shit, what? Ow, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you...
Yeah.
I just sort of... I didn't know what to do, so I kept going with the scene, and it worked out all right.
It's a great film.
He's an interesting guy. He's a... Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great film.
I'll tell you a quick interesting story about the end. We shot a different ending. We shot an ending where the original title of the film was 7 Year Storm.
Right.
Which I thought was a very cool title.
Yeah.
But the original ending had him throwing Vernon Trent, my character, into a fireplace and burning him alive.
Yeah.
Right? He comes up, catches him in his big mansion and marches him over to a fireplace. And I take a swing at him with a fireplace poker. He blocks the poker, grabs me by the... I'm wearing a white bathrobe at the time, and he throws me into a fireplace that's roaring fire, and he holds me in there, and I die. And that's the... That was the ending that they shot first. And then I guess they did a rough cut, and they looked at it and said, you can't do that, Stephen. Yeah. You can't... The hero can't just kill an unarmed... guy in a bathrobe and throw him in the fire. So we went back to shoot the something else. They decided, well, there's got to be some kind of a scuffle or something, and then we'll take Vernon Trent away in a cop car. He gets arrested. But we got back there, and they hadn't decided what it was, what that was, the alternate ending, what it was going to be. And so Bruce Malmuth, the director, said, "Well, I think you should grab Bill by the neck and kick him in the balls, and then throw him, maybe smash his face into the floor, and then because they wanted it to, you know, some sort of the villain has to get his comeuppance here.
Yeah,
you just can't kill him." And Seagal said, "No. I'm gonna grab him by the tongue. Rip his tongue out, smash his ears," and I'm like listening to this going, I'm standing there in a bathrobe listening to the two of them talk about, "No, I think you should rip his arm off and beat him to death with it and stomp his throat," and they finally, they got in a big fight, and Seagal stormed off the set because they hadn't decided what they were going to shoot, and he's in his trailer. You know, they gathered us all back. It was costing some $500,000 or something to shoot this one day back at that location with all of these people. And now he's in a trailer and he won't come out. And I thought he's got this little sawed-off shotgun that he's just stuck in my mouth. I thought, what if he... camera stays up on our faces and we watch we see the shotgun drop down out of frame like it's down around my genitals. And I start going, no, please, no, don't, no. Boom, it goes off. And I feel around and I'm still there. And then Seagal can say something like, "I don't know how I could have missed him. Must be smaller than I thought." You know, some wise ass.
Yeah.
Wise crack, you know. And I told the producers and the director this idea. And because it seemed to me better than what they were thinking.
Right.
And they said, that's great. But who's going to tell Stephen? Because if it came from Bruce Malmuth, he'd hate it.
Right.
So they said, "Would you go and explain this to him?" So I went to his trailer and I told him the idea, and he said, "Great, let's shoot it." And that's how the movie ends.
Yeah, excellent.
So,
I didn't know
there you go. I didn't even get writing credit.
Yeah. you still owed some residuals then.
I must be.
Yeah.
The idea is a compilation of ideas from other films I think I stole from. I forget whether it was Missouri Breaks or Oklahoma Crude. They're one of those two films.
Yeah.
There's a moment where we see a shotgun go down out of frame. The hero holds a shotgun up against Jack Palance's neck, and you hear a zipper go down out of frame, and he pees all over his leg. And it's like this humiliating, awful thing, and he can't do anything about it. And I just thought, you know,
yeah,
we need to... I like that idea anyway.
Yeah, no, definitely. Just a couple more questions. Another iconic role as Death in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Obviously some fantastic quotable lines there. What was that like? Is that a favorite role for you? You got to kind of be a bit bigger, be a bit funner?
I love that role. The Czechoslovakian accent.
Yeah.
I also, for some reason, I took on that character and began to... some of that was improvised. Some of that, again, was the character sort of inspired dialogue. You know, the character, the character could say things that I wouldn't have thought of. And like, what about my butt? You know, reaping burns a lot of calories. And I don't know. This he sort of took over me in a wonderful way that it doesn't always happen with actors, but it's fun. It's really fun when it does. You can kind of submerge in a funny character like that, and he just exists in that place.
Yeah.
That there's a moment where he's there in the hardware store, and he comes up to a customer in the hardware store who's smoking, and he says, "See you real soon."
Yeah.
And the guy goes, and the guy puts the cigarette out, right? He goes, "Oh shit." And puts the cigarette out. And that was an idea that I had on the spot, in the moment, right then and there. And I told Peter Hewitt, the director, and he said, "That's great." But we didn't have somebody cast to be the smoker. So Peter said, I'll do it. Bring the camera over here." And that's Peter.
Oh, wow, yeah.
That's the director smoking when I come by and say, "See you real soon." I mean, the film was kind of full of that sort of thing. It was like, it was a collaboration in the nicest sort of way when I felt free in that character to add things, change things. You know, not everything got in the movie, obviously, but there was a wonderful, playful freedom in that process that I really liked.
Yeah.
And
we still quote it today. I still say to one of my best friends, "You have sunk my battleship." I said it all the time. it's the way you did it with the accent. It's
you
great.
Ever sank my battleship.
Yeah. And is there any, because I've heard that rumors always abound about these things, but like that they're going to do a third one or one now.
I've been told they're writing a third one, and I spoke to Alex about it, and...
Death needs to come back, surely.
Well, one would hope, and I would love to do it. I would love to come back and reprise that character. I had so much fun playing him.
Yeah.
It's just a question. I'm not sure whether they've. I understand the biggest hurdle in the third one is, what do you do about Rufus?
Of course.
What do you do about the George Carlin character who was so important in the first one? And
of course, Carlin's just incredible.
And the second one, and now he's gone. So what do you? Yeah. I would love to come back.
And how did your role as... We were joking about this, but how did your role as President Ellis in Iron Man 3 earlier this summer come about? Because we were hoping if you were President Trent, it could have been the same character from Hard to Kill. But unfortunately not. How did that come about? And plans for the President to be back in future Marvel entries now that they've got this whole world thing going on? Or?
Nobody's... Actually, the folks from Marvel, someone from Marvel said, "Congratulations, we now have a president," which I thought was wonderful, but I haven't heard anything beyond that. I had a great time. So I auditioned for it. I went in and, you know, learned the lines and went in and auditioned and I got the role. That's how it came about.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times it isn't that they needed to see, you know, whether I could play this or play that. I think sometimes it's a comfort thing, you know.
Yeah.
They want to, and they also want to know, do you really want to do it? Does he, you know?
Yeah.
And I did. I thought it was terrific. I love those films.
And obviously Shane Black is another action director and
killer
writer from back in the day. So,
Seriously, what the most talented the most talented writer-director I've come across recently.
Yeah. Well, we loved the fact that at the end you basically had Don Cheadle and Robert Downey Jr. as the Lethal Weapon 2. Essentially, it was Riggs and Murtaugh, you know what I mean, running around on the bit at the end. Before
exactly,
the
with the banter
happened.
And the right. ribbing each other.
We loved it.
Well, I have no idea what Marvel has planned in the future, but I would be thrilled to come back. I think it's a great... Again, these things sort of feel like... I mean, they're fun to do. They're fun to do as an actor. They just are.
Yeah.
There's no getting around that, and any actor will tell you that. But they're also... I sort of look at them and think they're part of the fabric of our culture.
Right.
In a funny way. The films are a reflection of who we are at this moment in history, and it's nice to be a part of that fabric, of that collage, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
One of those pieces was me, which I find fun.
Well, we hope you come back anyway in future entries. Just lastly, because it's coming out soon, we've got Machete Kills back amongst
yes.
the action again. What can you tell us about your role in that? What can you tell us about Machete Kills?
Let's see. I play Sheriff Doakes. Again, because it's Robert Rodriguez, the action is very cool, and it's also very funny. He's got... I'm so drawn to writing like that when it's... Those are two things it's hard to get those in the same package, and you always get them in the same package with Robert Rodriguez. There's a tongue-in-cheek. There's a dark sense of humor underneath everything that he does, and I play a sheriff who's pursuing Danny Trejo's character. I'm not sure how much I can say without giving it away.
Right.
I'm not successful, and it doesn't end well for me.
Okay.
But Danny was unbelievably sweet. What a nice guy. I'd never worked with him before. Yeah, I play this sort of redneck Texas sheriff who talks about upstairs justice and downstairs justice. And right now, son, you're downstairs. And it doesn't look good for Machete. And then the phone rings. And it's Charlie Sheen, and we're off to the races.
Nice.
I'm no good at promoing these things. I don't want to. I don't know how much to say or not say. But it was super fun to shoot, and I have so much respect for Rodriguez. I just think he set up this wonderful place for himself, you know, this plant that gathered talented people around him, and in Austin, and does his own thing, which is so commendable and rare.
Yeah. Well, it's almost unheard of. I mean, it was sort of, I guess, the film brats of the 70s who tried to put together their own studios and things, but it really hasn't been till Rodriguez that someone's actually gone ahead and done it, you know.
And done it so well.
Right.
I mean, it's an amazing setup that he has, and it allows him to make these films. He doesn't have to go begging to Hollywood, or they don't have to cost $150 million or $200 million. And,
yeah.
You know, and he gets great people. Lady Gaga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the new one's got a great cast.
It's like, you know, you look at the cast list on that film and think, what the hell kind of movie is this?
Yeah, and there's clips in the trailer of Mel Gibson doing sword fighting and things. I mean, I've got no idea what to expect.
I know.
Be awesome. Yeah.
I mean, isn't it a kind of a must-see?
Oh, definitely. Oh, completely. Yeah, no, I had my ticket bought already.
And it's that grindhouse movie format, you know, this sort of feel to it. The old-fashioned... No, I love the whole idea of it.
And is that, so, is that, are they the kind of films you put on when you're sat at home and you want to watch some movies? Do you put on like action stuff and grindhouse stuff and things like that, or are you more into the classics, or what is it?
When I'm flipping around, I'm a sucker for, I like the ones that I get caught on all the time are the Matrix films, Godfather, and I guess those are classics.
Yeah, the big trilogies.
Well-made movies, but I don't know. Why is the Matrix such a great one for me? I just think it's wonderful. I get sucked into the whole sci-fi thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. What sort of movies do I watch when I'm home? Not usually my own.
Right. That must be difficult because you've done hundreds.
I don't sit in a dark room and watch. Right. And watch.
But you're in here.
Watch, here comes my scene.
Yes.
No, watch. Look what I do with my hand.
Get the family around the television. Look at me. Yeah.
No. Look at me. I see these films at premieres and red carpet things, and then I don't see them again usually. Yeah. I don't. It's sort of like listening to your own voice on a tape recording. You sit there and go, I don't sound like that.
Right.
That's not me. I don't sound like that. But of course you do.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for giving us your time this afternoon, and thank you so much for being on the After Movie Diner.
Oh, you've been wonderful, John. Thank you.
And you're doing great. You've got lots of films coming out soon, so
Homeland. I'm also doing. I just started doing episodes of Homeland.
Oh, great!
Another one I can't talk about.
Yeah,
I can tell you that I'm on it, but I can't tell you who I kill or don't kill or.
And is that like a reoccurring character? I believe it is. Excellent.
I believe it is. They don't share much information with anybody.
No.
That's okay with me, as long as the writing is as good as it is.
Yeah, definitely.
It's but yeah.
Well, best of luck with everything, of course, and we can't wait to see more of you in the future. And thanks so much again for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
Bye now.
Bye.
Well, like you heard, that was an awesome interview. He gave us some great insights, some fantastic stories, and he wrote to me a few hours after the show to thank me again and to say that he had a good time. He didn't need to do that. That's just pure class. You can't buy that, and I seldom, if ever, expect it. So just a really good dude, as they say. Anyway, now a roundtable discussion about his various performances featuring some familiar voices from the After Movie Diner's previous episodes. First up, to discuss his Tales from the Crypt work, its wearer of clothes, pincher of cats, and proud owner of a wax likeness of John Travolta riding a bull, it's Mr. Scott Toomey.
To me, to me, to me, to me, I'll pass the ball to him and Scott Toomey.
I was able to watch both the inaugural episode of Tales from the Crypt and Demon Knight.
Cool, and that is the man who would be death, or the man who is death, or something?
Man who was death, correct.
The man who was death, yeah. That's the first ever episode of Tales from the Crypt, and it's a sort of fortuitous thing that he does this, because he gets hired to do this first Tales from the Crypt episode, and then not only does that lead to him getting Die Hard 2, because obviously Joel Silver was a producer, but yep. It leads to him working with Walter Hill later in his career, because obviously Walter Hill was another producer, and it leads to him appearing in Tales from the Crypt no less, and Tales from the Crypt related things no less than four times. He's in both feature films, although the second feature film, Bordello of Blood, is basically... His scene is a repeat of the scene that he does at the beginning of The Assassin, which is series 6, except that at the beginning of The Assassin, he plays the Crypt Keeper's friend as Death from Bill and Ted, the Grim Reaper, and at the beginning of Bordello of Blood, he plays the Crypt Keeper's friend as like a crazy old mummy dressed up as like an English explorer type with a very posh British accent.
You're up on Sadler trivia.
I am. I actually managed to watch both Demon Knight and Bordello of Blood last night, and I've just watched both The Man Who Was Death and The Assassin today.
Yeah, very nice.
And it works out the same way that in Demon Knight he has a lead role, and The Man Who Was Death he has a lead role, and then in Bordello and Assassin he just has a small scene that kind of bookends the whole episode.
Oh, awesome.
So when did you first get into Tales from the Crypt, man?
Oh, wow. Probably when it was airing on HBO. So this probably would have been the later seasons that they were producing, but they were still replaying older episodes, I think. And the one that sticks out the most to me, I don't know if you remember this one. It sticks out the most because it's the one I remember the most. I think it's a motorcycle cop and some kind of criminal, and they get handcuffed to each other out in the middle of the desert. Do you remember this one?
I don't. Not off the top of my head, no.
Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but it's one of the only ones that I remember. But, yeah, it was definitely HBO. I remember, you know, staying up past my bedtime on the weekends, waiting till long after the parents had gone to sleep just so I could maybe see an episode of Tales from the Crypt and maybe catch a sight of some boobies on TV. And then I remember watching more when Fox started, you know, cutting them up to shreds and then airing them on their channel late at night as well on the weekends. But so since then, I guess maybe I was 13 when I first got into it.
I'm not even sure how I was aware of them, but somehow in England I was. I guess they aired them cut on some channel somewhere. Either that or I was aware of the films. I mean, I remember the poster for Bordello of Blood with the Crypt Keeper poking through the leg of the woman. Yeah. And I think I was just always a fan of puppets for starters, like growing up. And I was always a fan of like kind of slightly odd looking horror things. I remember seeing the image of the Crypt Keeper. I may have even seen like a VHS release of the Tales from the Crypt. Mm-hmm. There was something intriguing about the image to me. I don't know what it is, but that kind of sort of puppets and horror and thing, I don't know what it is, but at the time was sort of very interesting to me. And so I remember that, but I don't think I saw any episodes until much, much later.
Okay.
And I didn't see the movies until last night.
I can't actually remember if it was the old comic books from the 50s were being reprinted by a company in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I was picking those up and buying those. It was Tales from the Crypt. It was Vault of Horror. And Weird Science was another title. And I was buying those at the store.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if that came first and then I discovered the TV show, or if it was the other way around and the TV show inspired me to go out and look for the books or what have you. But
I think it also probably drew me in that you would get on the back of the VHS, you know, starring all these famous people, you know, and you'd be like, oh, that's weird. What is that? You know? Lots of things about the series probably piqued my interest, but I didn't see it till much later on. Of course, Mr. William Sadler appears in the first ever episode, which is a cracking episode. I mean, it's a really, really good one. You almost wish it was an hour. You almost wish that they'd
extended it by really quick.
Well, because he's so good in it. It's a really good episode. I mean, he's really great in it. And you kind of wish, because of his performance, which it hinges on. I mean, if his performance isn't good, the episode doesn't work. You kind of wish it would be longer, but it isn't. It kind of the big twist happens very quickly almost.
Yeah, it does. It goes by really, really fast. And I almost wish that I feel like probably the only way they would have been able to draw it out more would be if they, you know, showed more instances of him delivering swift justice upon, you know, criminals throughout the time that the death sentence is outlawed or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, you could drag it out to a feature almost in terms of you could have the detectives trying to figure out what's going on. You could have the justices deliberating over what they're going to do with the death penalty. You know, you could have the prison going to hell because prisoners aren't being killed or something. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
and you could choose whether you wanted to make it pro or negative death penalty, I guess. But it's a great episode. He's fantastic in it. He has a lot of monologuing and voiceover work, and wears a sort of Trilby hat. It's almost a nod to like the film noir of the 40s or something.
Yep. And I was reading somewhere that it was kind of at that point in time for like an episodic cable TV show, it wasn't a common thing for the character to break the fourth wall like that.
Right.
And I thought that was pretty cool. Also, just kind of as a side note, I also feel like he as an actor has one of the most convincing Southern accents I've ever heard in my life.
He's very good at accents in general. I was reading something on a biography about him, and he has a propensity for accents, put it that way. He has a knack and ability for them. I mean, we only get to hear him do sort of Southern, I guess, in this, right, and Shawshank, and then obviously the Death character. And
yep.
But I mean, like I say, the best bit of Bordello of Blood is the first 2 minutes with him playing this batty old English mummy.
Well, I watch Bordello of Blood for any scene with Corey Feldman in it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I found Bordello of Blood completely and utterly went too far into the realm of just utterly fucking ridiculous. And Dennis Miller was appalling. I mean, if you'd had Sadler in that role, or, I mean, hell, you could have had anyone in that role apart from Dennis Miller. I mean, I felt he was just so grating and whiny and unfunny and bad at acting.
Yeah,
and
I don't know why you would cast him in as a lead character in anything, you know, like Tales from the Crypt feature film or not, like... Dennis Miller?
Well, it almost felt like they rushed the second film into existence a bit quickly.
Yeah.
There's so much of it that's rehashed from the TV show. Is there anything... I mean, I haven't seen every single episode of the show. I've seen the first three or four seasons the most. Yep. But is there anything rehashed from it in Demon Knight?
How do you mean?
Well, just in the theme or the twist or the plot line or the characters or the jokes?
Not that I recall, anyway. Right. I mean, last night was my first time watching Demon Knight. I had only seen bits and pieces before that, and then before that, I had only ever listened to the soundtrack. So last night was my first experience watching Demon Knight from front to back. I loved it. I thought it was a really fun movie. I wish that Billy Zane would be in more movies that everyone saw.
Well, he's
in like straight to VHS movies now or straight to DVD, however.
Well, he's in Titanic. I love Billy Zane.
He's great. Yeah, Titanic is like the last big feature movie that he was in that, you know, more than 10 people would have seen.
I mean, I'm not sure how good Billy Zane is in terms of anything. I think that he is okay in Demon Knight, but for me, of all the people in Demon Knight, he's the one I'm watching the least, I have to say.
Oh, man, I don't know. He was kind of like the best part for me.
I just think you could have had, if you want slightly sarcastic, charismatic, seductive demon, sure, you can go the Zane route if that's what you want to do, but there's any number of actors who are possibly more... charming and less bald in the role.
Yeah, but... I will say that the quote-unquote seduction scenes weren't really... I didn't really buy him in those scenes. I thought he was kind of goofy and stupid in those scenes.
Right.
But the rest of the scenes that he was in, I thought he was really funny, and I thought he was playing the part really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of a... In the way he performs, he's kind of like a budget Tim Curry. He's not quite sleazy and charming enough to be a Tim Curry, but
I can see that.
It's kind of like a budget handsome Tim Curry, because obviously Tim Curry is not blessed with an overabundance of good looks. But
well, he played a damn good Phantom too.
Yeah, but that should have been Bruce Campbell. Let's be fair.
Yeah, you're very correct.
It should have been. But no, we're all here to talk about Sadler. So Sadler's role in Demon Knight, it's a hefty one. It's a leading role for Sadler, which is great. And he's great in it. Kind of a sort of Indiana Jonesy role almost.
Oh, I almost. And I don't know. I was getting Indiana Jones. I was getting almost kind of like a John Wayne vibe from him as well. Just kind of like that gruff leading man who's there to just kind of take charge and, you know, beat the bad guys kind of deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because he's from upstate New York.
Yep.
But he gives off such a kind of rough and tumble Southern vibe. I mean, you know, obviously you've got The Mist and you've got Shawshank and you've got Tales from the Crypt and stuff where he plays a Southerner, but he just kind of gives off that vibe very easily. I mean, he's a really good performer in that way that you don't, you're not like, you're not getting upstate New York from him in a lot of his performances.
Yeah, no, hardly anything, I think.
But no, he's great in Demon Knight. I love Demon Knight a lot. I thought Demon Knight had that good... What they don't really do anymore is that kind of good, goofy roller coaster horror. I mean, it fits into... You know, it fits into that Evil Dead 2, Darkman, Reanimator, you know, that kind of brightly colored... gooey, gory, fun roller coaster kind of mid 90s horror movie almost.
Yeah, I actually, one of the other movies I like to put in that category, and I actually thought about it a lot last night too after I was watching this, was that it almost seems like it could have been Tales from the Crypt movie, is The People Under the Stairs.
Right.
I don't know
why
this movie really. While I was watching it, I was just like, oh, this movie kind of reminds me of The People Under the Stairs for some reason. I don't know if it's the atmosphere that the storyline or the film creates or whatever, but something while I was watching Demon Knight reminded me of that movie for some reason.
And, of course, you get the battle of the That Guys with Dick Miller and William Sadler in scenes together. That's something of a treat. I mean, that's something of an embarrassment of riches, having the two of them square off in scenes, because... You know, Sadler's been in a million movies now, and Dick Miller is obviously the king of having been in every movie at a certain point. And, you know, to have them both when they meet up at the gas station, or wherever it is at the beginning of the movie, where they're swapping drinks and stuff, you're kind of like, that's awesome. It's kind of, it's not quite a passing of the torch, because obviously he went on to be, and Dick Miller went on to continue to be and stuff. But, you know, it's almost a passing of the torch from Miller to Sadler to kind of continue that vein of appearing in every genre film possible.
Yeah, it's silly.
As Sadler would go on to do, he'd go on to be in, being more sort of crazy stuff like this, some action, and also obviously like Water Hill stuff and dramas and, you know, TV and all that kind of stuff.
I've always loved actors like that could, you know, take on a leading role every now and again, but mostly show up as a supporting actor in all different genres. I've always enjoyed guys like that.
You almost wish that kind of level of kind of goofy, fun filmmaking had continued, because, you know, Sadler has got in Demon Knight, in Bill and Ted, in the Tales from the Crypt, in some of his more overt performances. He has got a kind of, you know, Jeffrey Combs, Bruce Campbell-esque kind of, you know, quality to him in terms of an untraditional leading man, an anti-hero type performance that would have been fun to have seen. Yeah, he did a ton of it, but would have been fun to have seen an actual kind of leading career come from that.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about a lot on the show, because we've had, you know, we've done a lot of Woods and Weller episodes, how people who are predominantly character actors, like someone like Woods or Weller, managed to have this like interesting, diverse leading man career, whereas other people who are no less good, you know, no less good actors, and you know, equally have as much screen presence, if not more, while they have tons of character roles to their resume, they haven't had so many leading roles. And I think Sadler kind of falls into that.
Definitely,
he's got the. Certainly, as a younger actor, he's got like the leading man look. He's got the jaw and the eyes and the hair and the whole bit. He can do the hero bit. He can do the, you know, he can be an attorney. He could be a cop. He could be an adventurer. He can, you know, there's not much he can't do in terms of, you know, villain or hero. You know, because obviously, Die Hard 2 and stuff. So,
and that ability has certainly kept him busy over the years. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, he's in like 8 or 9, even if you don't count TV stuff, he's in 8 or 9 things this year. And obviously he's got the big 2 releases, Iron Man 3 and Machete Kills. So
I like what you say about how you wish that more movies like this would be made nowadays, you know what I mean? Or movies like this were continued to be made between then and now. But I mean, if you think about it, this movie, if they were to try to make this today, it would never go to theaters. The Demon Knight was a theater release when it came out in when did it come out in 1996?
It was 95. Yeah, because then Bordello of Blood was 96.
Right. Yeah. This movie got a theater release. A movie like this would never ever get a theater release nowadays. No way.
No,
and
it's sad
because I like stuff like this. I would love to be able to go to the theater more and see movies like this. You know, every other month or every couple of months, maybe. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, definitely. There's something about the 80s and 90s, and it appears in almost every genre. They were just having more fun.
Yep.
You look at the action films. Obviously, I watch a lot of those for the doc action show and stuff. And you look at the horror films and things, and you know, people like, oh yeah, but I want my horror serious and gritty and grimy. And it's like, to be honest, I don't. I like a bit of silliness in my horror. I like a bit of like Dutch angles and a bit of hokey thunder and lightning and, you know, rubber puppet demon monster type stuff. I love all that stuff. You know, it's sort of lacking now. Everything's got a little too serious. I think somewhere along the line, everyone kind of went, oh, well, it has to be either a comedy or a serious thing. It can't have a sort of genre blend. And I guess the only movies that are doing that now are comic book movies, I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
That have a bit of everything. They have a bit of adventure, a bit of horror, a bit of comedy, a bit of action, a bit of whatever. But apart from that, you know, and even they're surprisingly straight-faced. Even there, you know, the comic book movies that people tend to, or seemingly gravitate towards are these serious, oh, they're saying something about life movies. And you're like, are you kidding me? He's dressing up in a cape, running around and hitting people.
It's
you know, that, you know, it always makes me laugh when people try and review the Nolan Batman movies, for example, like they're you know, sacred text or something. But anyway, Demon Knight I would have to say The Man Who Was Death, if it was fleshed out more, would be the top of the heap. But I think Demon Knight comes to the top of the heap just because it gives it a chance to kind of breathe. And it has a sort of interesting story with the whole Jesus flashback and everything. It's kind of interesting. It's not something you've seen before necessarily.
Right, yeah, no, definitely. I thought it was a really original story. I don't know if it was based on anything else or if it was just a straight up, you know, screenplay written directly as a quote Tales from the Crypt feature. So
yeah, it says unlike episodes of the HBO series, the story was not ripped from the pages of EC Comics.
There you go.
The first draft of the script was actually written in 1987.
Wow.
2 years prior to the HBO series debut. When it was intended to be made into a film by director Tom Holland, who obviously did Child's Play and Fright Night.
Yep.
So, yeah, it went through a whole bunch of stuff. It was even with Full Moon Features for a while.
Wow.
Until it eventually came back round to Joel Silver. But did you have any last points or any points on Sadler himself? We can talk about something else if you like. It doesn't have to be Tales from the Crypt, Sadler.
No, I mean, I always get so intrigued and so interested in your choices for who you want to base a program around as far as the actors. And William Sadler, I'll admit up until now, I actually didn't know what the guy's name was. I just knew that I knew him from Shawshank, and I knew him from most recently The Pacific. He plays a big general in that HBO war show. And those were the only two things that I, you know, had recognized him from. And then I, you know, watched him in Demon Knight last night, and I watched him in that Tales from the Crypt episode. And I'm, you know, from now on, I'm going to try to seek out other projects that he's done, because I definitely have taken a liking to him as an actor. I want to see other other kinds of stuff that he's been in.
And talking about other stuff he's been in, I'm now introducing to the diner the Full Moon fanatic and filmmaker Tim Gross and the man who wrote The Spookies Bible and is on the hunt for Lance Henriksen, Kyle Poling, from the Bloodbaths and Boomsticks podcast, which I guest on this week as well. So when you're done with this episode, go over to Bloodbaths and Boomsticks and check them out. Anyway, I just wanted to find out from them their favorite William Sadler stuff.
Oh, God, is there a bad one?
Yeah, I was going to even say there isn't a bad one.
He is really honestly one guy that I'll probably watch anything he does. There's like, he's great. He's great as a redneck in Myst. I fucking love Demon Knight. I think that's so underrated.
A lot of love for Demon Knight.
Love it. And Billy Zane in that movie is just like Darth Vader on Nitrous. He's great, too. and who can forget Death?
Yes, Death in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, William Sadler owned that character. I mean, people even to this day still reference him playing the Grim Reaper. I just think that's awesome.
He makes that movie. He makes that whole entire movie.
Oh, yeah, he really does.
He makes you want. I watched it 3 times in the first week it came out. It just from that movie, it made me want to go find more more films that William Sadler was in. I mean, he was in Hard to Kill with Steven Seagal.
I'll tell you one of my favorite Sadler movies, and I believe it's probably one of the last, quote, grindhousey type movies ever made, was Trespass.
Yes.
Just fan goddamn tastic.
That's the one with him and Bill Paxton.
Bill Paxton, yeah.
Walter Hill joint, that is.
Yeah, that's why I call it one of the last of the grindhouse. And I love him as just that stone cold evil dude in Die Hard 2.
Yeah. Holy, he's
great.
He's
actually on my TV right now for Machete Kills, so...
That's awesome. Yeah, you can see Sadler, obviously, Iron Man 3 this year, but also Machete Kills coming up.
Yeah, it was great. I never saw him advertised as being in Iron Man 3 when he showed up. I was like, oh!
He's always a pleasant surprise when he shows up in movies and you don't know he's going to be there.
Well, congratulations on keeping whatever that was you ate in Demon Knight down with the ketchup, because that looked disgusting. Oh, that was gross. It looked like split pea soup with a bunch of ketchup all over it. So good job, sir.
Hey, don't forget, he was also in the I can't even say the goddamn movie now with Tim Robbins and Shawshank.
Redemption. Yeah,
he was pretty cool in there. He's like the back roads redneck that.
Yeah.
He can't read or nothing, but
he's so good. He's like the jack of all trades. He could be like the stone cold businessman, the ruthless killer. I love him when he plays like the backwoods rednecky. He made The Mist for me. I love that movie. Him and that other dude in that, they were just so good together. I love the guy.
Excellent. All right, thank you guys. That will be part of the show next week.
Oh, can I mention one more awesome film?
Mention as much as you like, dude. Yeah, go ahead.
The Hills Run Red. Awesome goddamn horror movie. If you haven't seen it, people go check that out. That is good.
Very cool. All right, guys. Thanks ever so much. And it was great fun tonight. And you guys have a good time.
Okay, so my next guests are self-confessed tickler of ponies, boob obsessive, and one of the few podcasters I know who records his whole show naked atop a large spike. It's the host of Badasses, Boobs, and Body Counts, Mr. Mike Murphy. And Dr. Action himself, my cohort from the Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid commentary show, a man whose sneeze once decimated Chuck Norris's trousers, and baritone for an action-based barbershop quartet alongside Steven Seagal, Jeff Wincott, and Beyoncé. It's Mr. Paul Croson, or Dr. Action. Anyway, it's Mike's turn first, and what's your response, Mike, if I look deep into your dreamy eyes and say the name William Sadler to you over and over again?
You know, as a character actor, I think he's top notch. He's not somebody you think about until you see him on screen. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense, right?
I mean, from what I can recall, this is a question I'm really unprepared for.
I didn't prepare you for it.
No, that's okay. We know him from Shawshank. I think he's in The Green Mile.
He is in The Green Mile. He's worked extensively with Darabont.
Right. He's the villain in Die Hard 2, I think.
He is. He's also the villain in Seagal's movie Hard to Kill.
Yes, you really taxed my brain because I recall seeing him in Fringe. A great actor, actually. And he was most recently, I think, Iron Man 3.
He was, yes.
Didn't he play the president in Iron Man 3?
Yeah, I mean, he is Marvel's... I mean, if they're going to stick within... continuity, which they have done so far, he's essentially Marvel's president at the moment.
That's correct. That's correct. That's what I what I recall as well. Let's not forget his role as Roseanne's neighbor.
Is he Roseanne's neighbor? What does that mean?
Absolutely, in the sitcom Roseanne.
Oh, very nice, very nice. How late did Roseanne go?
You know, I don't know, but that's actually where I know him from more than anything else. He was the neighbor that came over, and he talked with Dan a lot. They worked on cars together. That's really where I know him from. Him and you know, amongst many other things that he was in. He's in a great film called Freaked from the early 90s, I think it is.
Yes, because, of course, he was in the second Bill and Ted film.
Yeah, yeah, Bogus Journey, I think that was called.
Yeah, and he's Dwight in Roseanne, the TV series. Yeah, he was in two episodes in 89, yeah.
There you go.
He did a lot of TV before he kind of hit movies.
Just a fantastic actor, I think.
I agree.
What it really boils down to, he's a guy you don't necessarily think about, but a guy you see often in film and TV.
When he's in a movie, you're like, oh, this is going to be good. This is it makes it better.
It adds levity to the film.
Definitely, definitely.
Very down to earth, it sounds like.
Very down to earth, man. Very, very, very cool guy.
And so you know what? That's why he works so frequently.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I think.
Sure.
And I'm excited to see that he's in Machete Kills.
He's like the sheriff in Machete Kills.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
In fact, in the trailer, he's the one who shoots Machete down from the hangman's noose because Machete is like strung up somewhere. Maybe it's not a hangman's noose, but he's strung up or something from a ceiling, and he shoots him down when the president calls him to get Machete to the White House or whatever. So
nice. It's always awesome when you get to speak to somebody in the business, and I would consider him. You know, I said it earlier. He's A-list on the B-list.
Yeah. I mean, dude, he will have been in Iron Man 3 and Machete Kills, two of the biggest movies this year, and he's in the show. So on the show, so it's like a bit crazy.
There's so many. I've just been looking through. He was great in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Awesome as death in that.
That's a top one for Brits growing up, I think. We all watched that.
He's a great, great villain in Die Hard 2.
You know, oddly enough, that film wasn't very good.
Die Hard 2.
He makes that film.
He's great. He's great.
See, I like Die Hard 2.
No, in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey is what I'm referring to.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I think he's great. I think he's just the bit where he says, you sunk my battleship.
And he was, by the way, he was brilliant in Die Hard 2.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And he goes, best of five? Damn right! I love that.
I love him in Trespass, Walter Hill film with Bill Paxton. Well, yeah. Robert Rodriguez has worked with him twice now.
Yeah.
He was in Road Races, wasn't he? And now he's in Machete Kills. So.
And did Rodriguez produce Road Races or direct it?
Directed it. It was Selma Hayek's first film.
Oh, really? Oh,
man, what a piece of ass she is, huh?
Nice.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the first thing that she did.
I haven't seen it.
I've got it, but I've not watched it yet. But he's in that. But yeah, he's good in everything. I thought he was really good in Iron Man 3 as well, as the president.
I want him back as the president in every... I want him in Avengers 2. Avengers 2. What do we reckon in terms of action villainy? Better in Hard to Kill or better in Die Hard 2?
Better in Die Hard 2.
Yeah, I agree. He
doesn't get to have a fight with Steven Seagal.
Yeah.
to the point where Steven Seagal just couldn't... I don't think he really actually got smacked in the face until Marked for Death. It was a big no-no that Steven Seagal couldn't fight. So I wish that Sadler had just popped him in the chops once at least.
I need to get the Die Hard films. Do you know I don't own those?
They've just released a new Blu-ray of all four.
I know. You know what? I gave my set to, I think, my cousin on DVD, thinking I was going to upgrade, and I just have never purchased the trilogy.
So. I still own the double disc special edition DVDs that came out in England like 15 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever.
The ones with the silver cases?
Yeah. Silver, gold, and I still have them.
I need to get those.
It's good. Got to get Die Hard. But yeah, he's great in Die Hard 2.
Yeah, I agree.
Nobody does better naked jiu-jitsu than William Sadler.
And so it's from Naked Jiu-Jitsu. So we're on our way home, and I'm getting 5 minutes with Mr. James Wallace.
Hello.
All about the actor William Sadler.
William Sadler.
And what are you going to talk about, sir?
I'd like to talk about... I've always really, really liked William Sadler ever since... ever since he was Death in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Yeah.
But I'd like to talk...
You have sunk my battleship.
You have sunk my battleship. Damn right. I wanted to talk about William Sadler's role in Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Because you're an enormous nerd.
Because I'm a big nerd. And look, okay, let's just get out of the way. Star Trek Deep Space Nine is far and away the best Star Trek series by, like, a country
Except
mile.
Except the original series.
Well, I don't know. I'm sorry. No. Deep Space Nine, in my opinion, is the best one. Okay. One of the reasons it's the best one is...
you're wrong.
You don't put... Anyway. You don't put... It's a different kind of show. But right. Instead of putting people on a ship... And they, you know, they chime around and go, hey, it's a red planet this time, and oh, and there's someone who used to be a Greek god, they want to kill us. It's people in a room, right? And then everything's happening around them, you see. So there's a lot more, character, and there's a lot more room for, like, for characters to grow and people to move and all the rest of it. So William Sadler turns up as a recurring character. I can't remember his name, I'm embarrassed to say.
Doesn't matter.
He plays someone from this shadowy part of Starfleet. And one of the things that's most annoying about Star Trek post-original series, like the Next Generation stuff, is they're basically flying between peace conferences, do you know what I mean?
Right.
And every time anyone turns up with a big gun, they go, but, you know, have a sandwich and let's talk about this. And at the end they go, all right, maybe I will have a sandwich and we'll talk about it. They go, another blow for sandwiches and peace, you know, and then do it at the end.
Right.
But in this one... He plays a character.
Who is that?
Sorry, we're just walking past the scene of a car crash.
Yeah.
Somebody rear-ended a truck, I think.
A taxi cab did.
Taxi cab. Yeah, anyway, sorry.
And the whole front of his cab has come off.
Yeah, yeah.
And only New York could be this noisy and busy at, like, 1 a.m.
Yeah, right.
So, anyway, carry on.
So he plays part of this shadow section... What was it? Section something. Anyway... They're a part of Starfleet that was, because in the world of Deep Space Nine, they're at war with this incredibly powerful race from another dimension, right? And they're losing the war quite badly. And everybody in, like, the Klingons and the humans and the Romulans, they're all teaming up because they're all, you know, they don't want to get annihilated. Anyway, this organization, shadowy organization behind the scenes,
let's go this way,
is set up and they have no, you know, no, there's no oversight. There's no one takes orders. They just do what needs to be done to preserve the peace so that people can live. You know, because people in Star Trek are always wandering around San Francisco and big windows and, like, floppy suits without buttons going, oh, that's so great being in the fucking future, isn't it? It's brilliant. And these guys work behind the scenes, like political assassinations, like playing off sides against each other, you know, working, you know, behind the guys, behind the diplomats, to make sure that everything continues in a nice, peaceful way so people can continue to live in a world without buttons. Deep Space Nine, this shadow organization is entirely represented by William Sadler.
Right.
So the reason he's such an interesting character in Deep Space Nine, the reason why he's so good, is that you've got this established thing where Federation, people who work in Star Trek, Federation, are good. Like, there's not even any doubt. They're always like, doesn't matter what you put me through, I will be good.
Even if they're Rene Aubergines.
But precisely. Right. They're all good, right?
Well, that black guy, who's like, really...
amazing. He's really, so, like, good.
Madly stares and...
Anyway.
Yeah.
But Sadler is all about the moral ambiguity, right? And he turns up and he kind of offers the Doctor on Deep Space Nine, like, a chance to, like, join... Section 8, I think it's called. I could be wrong about that, but anyway. But the reason he's so good is he doesn't shout, he doesn't yell, he's not like, but he's this incredibly menacing presence, because he's made it known that he has already played all this before. He's played this game before 1,000 times, and he is the one that is going to dictate how the outcome's going to come. And you're like, you might think, oh, well, you know, whatever the other characters are in this particular, you know, in Deep Space Nine, who may have been through tough times, and they may have defeated evil by staying true to their principles, as all good TV characters do,
right,
remain the same and you will be fine.
Right.
Sadler turns up, and his whole way of being, which is entirely comfortable with the idea of making whatever decisions, you know, are deemed necessary,
right,
completely unnerves everybody else because he's so calm. And instead,
so he's sort of like the Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross character.
Yeah, kind of. But he's
less of an arse.
Yeah, he's much. What's so cool about Sadler is whatever he does, there's just a tiny, even like in the dead serious character, there's always just like a tiny little bit of mischief.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like in his eyes. And what's so cool about him as this character is what could have been like a, you know, essentially like a moustache twirling villain,
right,
becomes this kind of like slightly mischievous, almost likeable character who is entirely happy with being completely in the shadows,
right,
and dictating things and knowing and predicting like the outcomes of things and, yeah, being always, you know, three steps ahead of everybody else and kind of having enormous fun doing it, but without, I don't know, without feeling the need to like morally justify himself all the time, you know,
right,
what I mean? He's,
yeah,
just there to do a job because someone has to do it. Anyway, I wanted to say he was really good in that role because of that mischief. It could have been really serious and really flat and there wouldn't have been anything at stake because you knew, you know, oh, he's a bad guy and the people on Deep Space Nine are good guys. So in this conflict between them, Deep Space Nine are obviously going to win out. He introduced uncertainty into that storyline, that dynamic, because, oh, they're coming right by us too, because of how likeable he is, because of how mischievous he is, the outcome of that episode becomes uncertain.
Right.
Because you don't know if he is necessarily going to lose, because his everything he is and every way he acts says, I've fought this battle 1,000 times before and I won every time.
Right.
You know? And that's why he's so good in that role. And he... The whole reason Deep Space Nine is so good is because of that. There's the whole thing is shot through with this moral ambiguity that means you never know what the fate of the characters is going to be.
Yeah.
You never know if they're going to end up being good or end up being evil, or whether they'll live through it or not, because everything in the whole universe is so uncertain. And he is the perfect choice for that character because of how he plays him. He's really, really great. And he's a part of... And I love Star Trek, and he's a big part of... like my favourite Star Trek series, so that's why I love William Sadler.
Well, thank you very much, Jim Wallace, on the streets of New York here at 1 a.m. or whatever it is. Thank,
yeah,
you very much.
We do love William Sadler.
Indeed. Thank you.
And saving the best for last, it's author, puncher of pastry chefs, and author, my friend and his, John Wallace. And you are going to be discussing which William Sadler performance today, sir?
Oh, well, I didn't have a particular one in mind. I mean, Bill and Ted's Bogus, obviously.
Yes.
And I was looking through his filmography, and I forgot he was in K-9. He has a really good little cameo in K-9.
Oh, yeah, he does have a brief
as
cameo.
As the car salesman.
Yes, indeed.
I
didn't ask him about Belushi. I should have asked him about Belushi.
Should have asked him about Belushi. That was a big miss. Should have asked him exactly how ludicrous an individual is Belushi. A very charming screen presence.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And very personable.
Me and my brother always loved Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure was always like... I think we saw that before we saw Wayne's World, and they were sort of the same kind of a deal, really. But I'm pretty sure we saw Excellent Adventure before Wayne's World, and then when we saw Wayne's World, we thought Wayne's World kicked the ass of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. But then Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, there's this whole third character of death. And what I forgot is that he actually gets onto the front cover of Bogus Journey, like grinning ridiculously with his white makeup on behind Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
And he just, and I think the reason why it's the best movie to discuss about him is he just completely lifts the proceedings to a totally different level by bringing in all this like really good comic idea of death as a like, it had probably been done before somewhere. But I'm not sure it's been done half as well, of death being this, like, slightly unsure of himself, like, you know, quite irritable...
Eastern European type.
Yeah, but with this Eastern European accent, which is a great thing. I mean, presumably, is it supposed to be Eastern European or Scandinavian? Is it supposed to be connected to, like, your the movie with the knight on the beach.
Ingmar Bergman film.
His makeup and outfit is.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
The Seventh Seal.
The Seventh Seal, I think so.
So he's dressed up like the Seventh Seal Death, but just doing this really good comedy stuff. And me and Jim always loved our particular favourite bit. And it's a great little idea as well, which, again, you watch and you think, this must have been done before. But I don't know if it was done before, of challenging him. You know, he says, you may challenge me to any game, and he expects sort of chess, you know. And instead they come up with Twister and...
I think there's a Woody Allen short story that's similar... But I think the Woody Allen short story is ripping off The Seventh Seal, because I think it's about death and someone playing chess, but in like an apartment or something. But apart from that,
About this is they bring out these like ludicrous modern games like Twister and, most importantly, Battleship. And me and Jim, for, I don't know, half our lives, have probably quoted to each other, "You have sunk my battleship."
Yes.
And it was just, it was really well done the way that, he played a really big role in lifting that film far above Excellent Adventure. I mean, I might be being mean to Excellent Adventure, but I don't think I am. I think Bogus Journey is just much better because it's a three-hander, and instead of just them going, dude, it's him in there sort of being annoyed by them and sort of, you know, slightly beholden to them because of, you know, their quite literally dumb luck.
But he also is sort of won over by them ultimately, isn't he? Because he sort of escorts them or happily introduces them to God, and there's all that business where they're all dressed up as... I love the way the fact that Death goes incognito and doesn't bother to change out of being Death. He just puts like a smock and a hat on over the top of his deathly robes, which I love. Yeah. I also said that, you know, the best out of five, when he goes, "Damn right!" So I would do that all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but that scene's the best. I also really love the way he, like, when he gets up on stage, he does that side thing with the side.
The side thing is brilliant, but I love him playing Cluedo as well. I believe it was Colonel Mustard in the dining room with the candlestick. It's the way it says candlesticks, right? With the candlestick. I just loved it. It was brilliant accent, brilliant face, brilliant delivery. Raises the whole film. And that will always be his seminal achievement for me. But like I say, I love his turns in things like Shawshank and K-9 as well.
Yeah, definitely. I agree, dude. I agree. He's a great presence. He's very good at, you know, like all sort of character actors or what they call that guys that kind of crop up throughout the industry and throughout the history, he's really good at just sort of becoming a role. I mean, you look at even the ones that he's done with Darabont, which are all fairly similar, they're still very different from the character that he plays in Shawshank, to the character he plays in The Green Mile, to the character he plays in The Mist. And although they all have similar touchstones, there's a big difference in it. He's also... You know, I mean, he started off, as far as films are concerned, doing Hard to Kill and Die Hard 2, these sort of two big villain roles, which, again, are completely different. You know, in Hard to Kill, he's this, like, benevolent or seemingly benevolent, sleazy kind of senator who's, you know, glad-handing people and grinning and has this little catchphrase, "You can take that to the bank," that whole business. And then in Die Hard 2, he's this very stern, very... you know, tan, muscular, greased up kind of...
That's true. He does a good job in Die Hard 2 when he's... he does a really good sinister moment where he's talking the plane down into a crash.
Yeah.
Talking to them in a very sort of friendly, like, talking to them from the tower kind of voice. Very friendly. "Yeah, coming in, you're looking good. Yeah, bit of wind there." And he just guides them straight into a crash. That's one of the few, like, good moments in Die Hard 2.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I actually like Die Hard 2 a lot more than people give it credit for, but I think a lot of that has to do with Sadler as well. And, you know, he's then gone on to both be in action movies, adventure movies, dramas, you know, comedies. He's kind of run the gamut. It's got to have been a much more interesting career than just, say, you know, being Mel Gibson or whatever, or being... you know, Eddie Murphy or whatever, being these people who just every movie are expected to do the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was there any prior to that recognition that, oh, it's William Sadler, or bothering to like find out who it was, or when he showed up, were you just always kind of pleasantly happy that he was in the movie?
Yeah, he's a face that you like to see.
Right.
Yeah. I don't go, I've got to be honest, I don't go, oh, it's a William Sadler flick, and rush out to see it, because he's more of a supporting actor, isn't he, really?
Right.
But he's always really nice to see, because he's got a great face, he's got fantastic delivery, and he's, you know, and he's got a, yeah, I mean, what more could you want? I mean, there's a lot of shit. He's a kind of, he's one of those people who, you know, you and I could line up, like, you know, 20, 30 actors who could have replaced half the cast of this summer's blockbusters and just done an infinitely better job. Like, for instance, he could have dropped Sadler into Pacific Rim. He would have vastly improved it.
Yes.
I'm sure. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I'm sure he would have done.
Yeah.
I'm sure he would have. I'd far rather have seen Sadler in the main role in... I'm not getting carried away. I've leapt here. But, you know, I'd far rather have seen him in the main role in, for instance, something like that. What was that Tom Cruise...
Oblivion?
No, not Oblivion. The...
Jack Reacher?
I'd far rather see him as Jack Reacher than Tom Cruise, because he's tall and a lot more... And a lot more has a grizzled face that looks like it's seen some action.
Right.
Instead of, like, do you know what I mean? Instead of like a...
No, I understand. I mean, I don't know. He's had
He doesn't look... Like, Cruise looks manicured, and that part is not supposed to be fucking manicured. It's supposed to be a bit grizzled and interesting. I would have far rather seen him do that.
Sure.
But you know what I mean? You know what I mean for the Pacific Rim point? Like, all of these big summer blockbusters, you could have dropped him into. And like, for instance, I would have... If he'd turned up in Wolverine, would have been great to see him in Wolverine somewhere. Would have been, you know,
well,
it would
he's technically, well, when does Wolverine take place? He's technically the president now of the Marvel Universe, because he's in Iron Man 3 as the president.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
So technically, if Marvel is going to stay within the same timeline, right, I mean, we don't know, obviously, if President Ellis, which is the character he plays in Iron Man, is at the beginning of his term or the end of his term, or whether he's had two terms or what. So, I mean, yeah, he could be replaced if they go, well, we've just had a big election and, you know, Jeff has been, President Jeff.
Or he's been shot down at some point, because Hollywood is obsessed with shooting down Air Force One at the moment.
Right. Well, no, that happens in Iron Man 3. Have you seen Iron Man 3?
Yeah.
Right, no, he is... I mean, the reason why that happens in Iron Man 3 is it's very, very clear that Shane Black was just like... And almost the reason that Sadler is in it, although he said he just auditioned, Shane Black was clearly just trying to make a B-movie 80s and 90s action film. And, like, the fact that it happened to be an Iron Man flick was sort of secondary. Yeah. I mean, he writes it very well, so that the whole purpose of, like, Tony Stark being Iron Man rather than the robot being Iron Man is the through line of the movie, and also the through line of the whole trilogy, which is awesome. Very well done in terms of tying loose ends together. But if you look at the structure of Iron Man 3, and I watched it again last night, it's an old school action movie. And, you know, kidnapping the president, or taking down the White House, or taking down Air Force One, or taking down whatever, that's like an old school action idea. And
he's not limited to action. And like I say, he's just one of these people.
No, I'm talking about Shane Black, though. I'm saying the guy.
But for instance, like either of the White House movies, you could have dropped him into and they would have been vastly improved.
I'm surprised he wasn't in both of them. Like, it's just
in a way, I am surprised that he wasn't in them. The natural fit, especially White House Down, which could have really used. Could have really used him, or someone just to put some jump leads to James Woods for that movie. But you know what I mean. He's a pleasure to see, and he's one of these like core of like, you know, probably a lot less than I said before. Probably like 5 to 10 supporting actors that it's always a pleasure to see and go, oh, cool, he's cropped up. I wonder what he's going to get up to.
Did you know on a slight tack?
Which I think is one of the greatest compliments you can pay any actor.
Yes, completely. I mean, the nice thing about Sadler, I have to say, to stay on topic, is as an actor, he seamlessly blends into an ensemble cast or a third lead or a supporting role or whatever. And he can be sort of from anywhere. He can be from anywhere in the States. He does a great line in accents. He can be, you know, working class, middle class, upper class. He can kind of do a bit of everything. He can be businessman. He can be, you know, the president. He really does cover the gamut. So him blending in is meant as a compliment, most definitely. But he's also one of those character actor blender inners type that when you see him, you're really happy that he's there, even though you're going to just assume he's his character and buy him as the character. You're also just happy, hey, it's Sadler, and there we are, and off we go, you know. Well, great. Well, look, thanks ever so much for being on the episode, sir.
No worries. Always a pleasure.
Like the show? Well, you can find our complete podcast archive over at amdpodcast.blogspot.com or aftermoviediner.com. You can send us an email at aftermoviediner@gmail.com, tweet us at aftermoviediner, or follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/aftermoviediner. Or why not be a part of the show and leave us a voicemail over at speakpipe.com/aftermoviediner. You can also support the show a number of ways, by spreading the word to family, friends and co-workers, by writing us a review over at iTunes or TalkShoe, by purchasing some excellent diner merchandise over at cafepress.com/aftermoviediner, by donating on our website, by advertising with our website, or maybe you're a regular Amazon user. If so, then before you make a purchase, go to amdpodcast.blogspot.com, aftermoviediner.blogspot.com, or aftermoviediner.com and click through the Amazon banner ads. It costs you nothing extra, but they throw us a few coins for the trouble. Or, like the movies we cover, then buy them over at our personal Amazon store, also on amdpodcast.blogspot.com. Really, thanks everybody for everything you continue to do, and please keep listening.
And now to play us out this week, weirdly enough, we have William Sadler with a song of his own composing.
This is a song about, this is a, these are all original songs, which is why you don't know them. Otherwise, I know you'd be singing right along. This one is called, a song I wrote about the way that I learned to play the guitar. And it'll explain a lot, I think. I want to play something in the key of C. The key of C is just fine with me. I'm as happy as a man can be, as long as we keep it in a key of C. I learned to play on my daddy's knee, and fellas, he was stubborn as a donkey. He only showed me one key, and the key was C. It's gonna have to do for me. Now if we play it in A or B, well, you won't see my virtuosity. I got nothing against D or E or F or G, but goodness me, C's a key that's got no sharps or flats. And fellas, that's the reason I keep saying, as long as we keep playing in the key of C, it's absolutely fine with me. When I try, when I try to play a jazzy riff, my hands get stiff, augmented or diminished. Oh, honey lamb, I'm finished, for the key of C is absolutely fine with me. Oh, we. Hey, I can play a song so sweet without those sharps and flats. That mean old dogs behave like pussy cats. Republicans begin to dance like Democrats when I play it in the key of C. Ooh-wee, play it in the key of C. Won't you please play it in the key of C?
Holy smoly. Righteous. Dude, come on in, come on in.
there are men, and then there are second unit podcast men. The podcast you've just been listening to is part of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at 2upn.blogspot.com or on Facebook under the Second Unit Podcast Network. Our fantastic list of shows include Drunk on VHS, We Came from the Basement, No Budget Nightmares, The After Movie Diner, Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid, and Bloodbaths and Boomsticks. Take one podcast into the shower. Don't be a blithering idiot, Alan. We can give you the multiple podcast cleansing system all in one place your hair deserves. Our programming is available across all platforms, from iTunes to Podomatic, TalkShoe to Stitcher, so you have absolutely no excuse. Listen today, and a free naked person of your choice will be shipped from Thailand to your door in a matter of weeks. The Second Unit Podcast Network, bringing you the action and leaving the boring stuff to the other guys. Bloody hell, who does a girl have to blow around here to get a decent beverage?